Welcome back to Future Ready Through M&A, the Fidelity podcast focused on M&A activity and strategy in the independent wealth management space. I'm your host, Scott Slater. In prior episodes, we identified several keys to a successful inorganic strategy, including knowing your why for doing M&A in the first place, determining whether you're a buyer or a seller, ensuring the right fit or alignment between both sides of a transaction, and the all-important understanding the nuts and bolts of M&A transactions, how they actually get done, learning post-deal integration strategies, and in our most recent episode with Marty Bicknell and John Copeland, how an inorganic strategy helps to achieve innovative business objectives beyond simply scale. But one of the most critical elements in the last several years of record-setting M&A results is the need for capital, and significant amounts of it, at the ready. In a long-term seller's market that characterizes the independent wealth management space, buyers need to be ready to move quickly, kind of like what many of us have experienced in the last couple of years in the housing market. The buyer with ready financing, and better yet, cash, is much more likely to win the property. Today, we will explore the importance of capital and the rise of substantial private equity investments over the past several years, and how that is enabling record levels of M&A activity and reshaping our industry. Our Fidelity transaction reports, which we began in 2016, identify 46 private equity firms which have invested at some level in RIA firms, representing an astonishing 469 deals during that period. And as we have all noticed, it's increased significantly in just the last couple of years. In 2018, for example, PE-backed buyers purchased 43 firms comprising $40 billion in client assets under management. By 2021, just 3 years later, that had risen to 126 deals, nearly tripled, and $158 billion in assets under management. And looking at year-to-date 2022 through the end of October, that has increased yet again to 135 deals and $174 billion. And these largely PE-backed strategic acquirers, those who have completed three or more deals in the last 12 months, are responsible for three quarters of all the deal activity and 60% of the assets under management. So clearly, capital is enabling significant M&A activity. So let's explore this important topic with a focus on private equity to understand how it works. What are their investment objectives and strategies? Why are they focused on wealth management now? What is the time horizon of their investments? And on the other side of the coin, what's the dynamic between the sponsor and the RIA firm? And what role does each party play? And for firm leaders, when do they decide to consider private equity capital? And what are the advantages in the private space for growing firms? And finally, how can private equity help to actually build a better enterprise? Many of us think of private equity in the traditional sense, with large players such as KKR, Warburg Pincus, and TA Associates, generalists who invest in multiple industries, and all of whom are today in wealth management in a significant way. In reality, private equity is not a monolith, however. There's a spectrum of capital players, all with different strategies and strengths. For example, there are more wealth management-specific private equity players, including firms like Lightyear Capital and Wealth Partners Capital Group, or Merchant Investments, each of whom deploy various strategies which leverage their industry expertise. And finally, there are more passive investors, what some may refer to as permanent long-term capital investors, such as family offices and sovereign wealth funds, who are interested in the recurring cash flow for their investors. Firms also vary in how they intend to drive value in their investments, including different board and governance models, providing M&A deal expertise, everything from sourcing to structuring to access to capital to the firms they invest in, and providing management and operational guidance and support. In short, it's important to understand that private equity is often much more than simply capital. The right capital partner can help an enterprise to execute their operations more effectively, find key talent, and navigate the challenges of growth and scale to help create a more sustainable enterprise that, in the end, will deliver a better client experience and result for a firm and clients. Today, we will speak with Jeff Decco, CEO of Wealth Enhancement Group. Jeff brings deep expertise with private equity over his career, beginning with his role on the executive team of a consumer products business, which sold to Procter & Gamble. He has led Wealth Enhancement Group for 20 years, and since 2016, Wealth Enhancement Group has completed 44 transactions. During his tenure, the firm has partnered with five different private equity sponsors as they have accelerated their growth strategy. We're going to discuss how capital partners have enabled Jeff and his team to grow and execute, what different partners seek, and how to align sponsor and firm objectives, as well as the time horizon for those investments, to achieve meaningful results.
Jeff, it's great to have you here this afternoon. I look forward to a great discussion on something that I think you bring a lot of insight to. So thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks, Scott, for having me. It's always fun to talk about the industry. And, you know, I think the private equity space is you know, had a huge impact here, but in lots of places. And, you know, private equity gets this sort of reputation sometimes as, you know, big, bad private equity. But in fact, private equity actually is a huge contributor to quality and thinking about how do businesses and companies and industries mature. And I'm really excited to talk more about it today.
Well, great. And I think you bring a lot of experience to it. And I think that's a big part of what we want to do today is shed some light on what is the role of private equity and how is this helping us to make ultimately a better industry. And I think we'll get into that. But before we do, let's go back and talk a little bit about your own history with private equity. You've been running Wealth Enhancement Group for what, close to 20 years now?
Yeah, I kind of consider myself the accidental CEO. So I came into the company, I'd had a career where I was traveling like crazy and just, you know, going full tilt all the time. And I had a one-year-old and a three-year-old. And locally, I was like, you know, I think I'm going to kind of buy a few local businesses so I don't have to get on a plane. My goal was that I could be home at dinner for my kids. And so I made a little bit of a lifestyle choice, but it was really a choice by which we said, it was myself and two partners. And they one of them was a sub-debt firm, you know, so doing private placement type work on the debt side, but a little bit of equity as well in terms of what they did. And then the other was a more of a high net worth investor. So they sort of had sort of trappings of private equity in terms of their mindset. And I had worked with private equity in other lives before that. But my goal was like, you know what, I'm going to get involved in businesses that serve clients locally, and I'm going to not get on a plane.
And frankly, you were going to be more of an investor than an actual operator,
yeah,
right?
Well, totally, yeah. Accidental, right? Yeah. So, you know, we put the deal together. We were about to close, and just, you know, great guy that was running the firm, you know, just looked at me and said, you know, I'm not sure I want to run this full time anymore. And I said, oh, well, that's a bit of an issue. We've signed all the agreements. We have capital, you know, sort of gearing up to be placed. And what are we going to do? And he said, well, why don't you come in for a while? And of course, I looked at my two partners and I said, well, I kind of got us in this mess. So I'll do this for 6 months and, you know, we'll find somebody else and off we go. But, you know, 23 years later or 22 years later, I mean, here I am and still having a great time.
That's awesome. And you became a real student of the business, and I think you've done a lot. So you went through a number of years where you were primarily focused on growing it organically, right? And
oh, yeah.
Really expanding it in that fashion. And I've seen this pattern a lot with many of the firms that with which you compete for yeah. Firms that they grew organically for a long time and then came to a point of getting into a little bit of an organic strategy. Tell us a little bit about what led you to that point and why.
Yeah. Well, look, I think, you know, maybe it was about a year or so ago I was at Tiburon and speaking about this. And I said, you know, boy, I think, you know, I'm supposed to talk about sort of this, you know, we're this, you know, really big company or whatever. I think we're smallish or medium sizedish, right? But that we're very active in the M&A space, mm-hmm. and all that. And I, you know, so I stood up and I said, well, you know, building a company through M&A is really a terrible way to build a business. And I would say that, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't get to control the external dynamics. And so I think, you know, such as like capital flowing into the industry, right? That, you know, the private equity space is pushing capital into this business. So, you know, that's not something, you know, I have to decide what do I do with that, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's also some trends that are sort of saying consolidation matters, right? Other industries consolidate. And what are the fundamental drivers of consolidation? And I think those things come about. I call them the external factors, right? And if you, you know, control what you can control, mm-hmm. and then look at what you can't control and decide what implications it has for your business. And so we really saw emerging just this really strong, you know, sort of capital coming in, forces within the industry, demographics.
And when was that starting to happen?
So we really saw that as early as 2009, 2008. Okay. Mm-hmm. So our first private equity firm after, you know, the partners and I came together was a group called Norwest Equity Partners who came in at the end of 2007. And, you know, their thesis was that consolidation was starting to occur. At that time, you had NFP that had sort of focus was just emerging, right? Mm-hmm. And there was sort of corollaries to that. And there's a insurance brokerage business is about 10 years ahead of our industry. And they were already, you know, private equity firms were already seeing that emerge. So there was an initial hypothesis. We just had this thing, you know, GFC happened, right? And so kind of everything moved sideways for a while within that. And so we emerged out of that GFC, and then we really did our first transaction there. It was late in their hold period. Mm-hmm. We had also grown tremendously organically. It was late in their hold period.
You might just explain for our audience too, what do you mean? You know, some of these are for basics, but hold periods. Explain a little about what you're talking about.
Actually, that's a
lot of this is around alignment of capital and everything.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, I think most advisors understand alternatives, right? And they, you know, when a private equity firm or a VC firm, you know, raises capital or a sub-debt firm, they typically raise it, you know, the most common sort of structure is that the commitment, so if someone says, I'm going to commit $1 million, the private equity firm will then draw that down. And typically the drawdown period is kind of 2 to 3 years. Mm-hmm. And what that means is, hey, you committed $1 million, we want 100,000 right now because we're making an investment in a company. And, you know, 6 months from now, we're making another investment, we want to draw down another 100. And there's a limit, right? So that's kind of the commitment being drawn down. Drawdown period is kind of the first, you know, 2-3 years. Target funds are 10 years in terms of kind of cash to cash, meaning I give you the cash, but I would like the cash back. And then PE firms typically have the option to extend in 1 year increments for usually 2 to 3 periods, right? So it could be as much as a 13-year commitment, and they all differ, right? I mean, that's a very big generalization. And I think advisors are familiar with that, right? So when you have a PE firm coming in as an investor, you kind of want to know where they are in their cycle. Because, you know, if they're drawing down capital, making their investments in the first kind of, you know, before you would have said in the first kind of 4 years-ish, it's been much faster lately. They've been deploying capital. All PE firms in the last kind of 3 to 5 years have been deploying capital faster. So typically that's going to be a 3-year period, you know, but occasionally like they might slip in where it's year 5. You know, you want to be careful, right? Because if they're at year 5, you know, they're going to get to the end of their hold period, and then they're going to make a sale decision, right? Because it's more driven by their commitment to their limited partners than it is about what's optimal for the business. And so you want to be early, right? So, you know, we partnered with TA Partners in 19. I think we were one of the first investments out of that. So really early in that fund, that's an important place to think about where you're at. When we were with Norris Equity Partners, back to what we were talking about with GFC and kind of going sideways a little bit, their hold period was a little bit longer. We were in the kind of 7-year mark, which is longer for this space. And, you know, I think typically the hold period that you should expect is kind of a 4 to 6 year period.
Right.
And I always think it's funny, right? Because people talk about, you know, oh, the, you know, it's short term. I have a different view of that. I mean, you know, when each of us individually are buying a publicly traded equity, it's like, you know, thinking about holding it for 4 to 6 years, maybe. Maybe not, right? And you kind of think about the velocity or the turnover of positions, right? I think about an investor as a 4 to 6 year period. That's a healthy chunk. I mean, you can get a lot done in that cycle with that kind of capital.
I find that many of our listeners often think more in terms of more permanent capital. They're taking on an investor and they're going to be there for some time. And frankly, there are forms of that. You see that with family offices and sovereign funds and different versions like that, that are probably more interested in the dividend. But what you're talking about is more active, in a way, more active fund-driven sponsor management and that dynamic. And to understand that there is going to be, it is going to turn over, and to think in terms of recycling that equity as you're doing it.
Yeah. I mean, look, we've, you know, we recycled several times, right? Mm-hmm. And that's become much more common. If you kind of go back maybe 20 years ago or so, you didn't necessarily, it wasn't as common to have a PE to PE transaction. It happened, but it wasn't quite as common. It's incredibly common today. The size of transactions that are in the private space have gone up dramatically. You know, and there's a lot of advantages in the private space for growing firms, right? You're not in a place where you're managing earnings. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just the concept of managing earnings, right? You know, in the public space, you're managing earnings quarter to quarter. So that's on one side. I think private equity really tends to have a longer period, right? It tends to be, look, you know, what we're doing here in the first early couple of years of our hold period is we're investing in making this a better business. We have hypotheses about how things can improve and how we can be supportive. So there's typically an investment phase even in each of the companies that they might participate with. So I think it's really powerful, right? And then they work through and they say, okay, how do we optimize this? And then where is the right buyer for this business? And that goes all the way back to, you know, we were with NEP. Their original hypothesis was the industry was going to consolidate. great financial crisis pushed it sideways, right? Pushed it deeper into their hold period.
Sure.
We did a couple transactions late. And then, you know, it was a really great conversation when we made that decision. Is we went to them and said, look, we need to open up more capital to us to do transactions. And they said, look, we're late in our hold period. We agree that is the right thing for this business. And because of that, we think that it's the right time for us to exit. And let's help find the right next partner. And not all private equity is the same.
Right.
But there's this belief that, you know, private equity is pulling all the strings in these companies. I mean, that's not it at all. I mean, great private equity firms, you know, they make money in their model by raising capital and deploying capital. When something like having to run a company mm-hmm. gets in the way of raising capital and deploying capital, that's not good, right? So they don't want to run companies. They want to back management teams within it.
So again, you've gone through Norwest Equity Partners, then you went to Lightyear Capital.
Yep.
And how long was that period? And then you went to TA.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. It's such a great example because, you know, people will, they'll always say 4 to 6 years.
Yeah.
You know? And so NEP was a little over 7. Lightyear was just a shade over 4 years.
Okay.
And then TA came in and they were with us for 2 years, mm-hmm. still a partner with us. But we actually, after 2 years, brought in a second firm as well called Onyx.
Okay.
And so, you know.
And, really, and what led you to that decision just to, from a capital standpoint? Why was that the right time?
For us, we have two financial sponsors or two private equity firms that are in. And so they're there to help us as we might look to capital intensive sort of transactions that might come forward where we might need to bring in significantly more equity mm-hmm. within that. But then they also have, you know, limiteds that might also have that type of interest and it's sort of, you know, behind them. And so now the sort of opening up the aperture of equity capital that we could maybe access, you know, if it's right, right? I mean, if the situation's right for us and right for them. What I love about private equity, really simple ownership structure, right? I got one phone call. I've got my employee group that I'm constantly in contact, my employee shareholders, and I got one outside group. Like when I've got a major decision and I'm looking for a little advice, it's one phone call, right? Or sometimes I'm like, no, I want them to kind of ride with me on this decision. This is a big deal for us, right? And I want them to have some vested interest. And, you know, I really, you know, that's what I like about it. And it lets us just move so fast.
So let's talk a little bit about private equity coming into our space of independent wealth management. And, you know, and I think the pattern that I've seen in so many industries, and we certainly have seen here is, you know, private equity has been part of this space for many years, but it tended to be, I would say, specialist firms, Lightyear being an example, that really knew this industry well. And the last 2 to 3 years in particular, I think we've seen many of the major generalist players that are investing in a wide range of industries come to this space. What's leading more of these firms? What are they seeing in wealth management that they really like that is causing them to do that?
Yeah, look, I think there's probably a couple catalysts to it. I mean, I think even as you look at some of these larger firms, they might be generalists, but they probably have a very specific FIG group, mm-hmm. you know, that specific,
certainly.
Financial services group mm-hmm. where these folks, that's all they're doing. So I think that's, you know, within that, you know, they might have 3 or 4 sectors that are really sort of where they're going to invest their capital. And they're looking to manage their, you know, their fund, whichever their current fund is, to have a, you know, an appropriate or a target weighting to those sectors.
Sure.
And then the expertise within it. So even
we're seeing dramatically more capital in the last 3
absolutely.
Years, just based on what we're tracking at Fidelity than say 5 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, look, the things that are driving that, right, there's sort of the external part is, the fact of the matter is these firms, these PE firms, are raising bigger funds, right? I mean, the size of these funds are getting pretty mm-hmm. significant, right? Mm-hmm. And the question is that demand driven, right? Or is that really opportunity driven? And I think the answer is both, right? The private equity has had a banner decade, mm-hmm. right? I mean, just for sure. And across all industries. And so when you think about the allocations of all the large funds, you know, around the world, the endowments and the funds, like allocations have moved up, right? So that's sort of increased the amount of capital in the private equity space. At the same time, I think you see a couple things that have happened in the space, which is that they are going after, they are having success with larger sort of enterprise value firms in a lot of ways. And I think that you combine those two things, which is you got ready capital that's sort of playing on the momentum that private equity has shown. Mm-hmm. And then you balance that with there's more opportunity and the idea of being private is appealing to a higher, you know, to a higher sort of market cap or enterprise value level.
Is there anything though further beyond that specific to why they like wealth management so much in an accelerated way?
Yeah, for sure. So bring it to wealth management. Look, I think, you know, I'm a believer that, you know, I'm not trying to to invent the crystal ball mm-hmm. or try to look into the crystal ball. I'm a believer. Like I was a history major, right? Mm-hmm. So you know, I just look and say, well, what's happening elsewhere? And I think you see that same sort of thinking coming out of the PE space, right? So think about roll-ups or consolidating activities. It's, you know, it's really a platform. Mm-hmm. What I would tell you is that if you were to go back maybe 30 or 40 years ago, I think the public markets, the idea that there was a liquidity premium, mm-hmm. right? So in other words, if you were liquid, you typically, you know, the valuation of the firm had a premium, liquidity mm-hmm. premium. Mm-hmm. Somewhere that has reversed, and specifically kind of reversed in more of the consolidating spaces. And this is any consolidating mm-hmm. space, right? Which is that there's a, you know, capital is believing that it has an advantage if it's private when it's going through the consolidating phase. Mm-hmm. And you can see it, you know, you can see it today and you know, just in terms of how are platform firms that are driving this consolidating being valued as a multiple of EBITDA versus firms that, you know, and there's not that many, but versus a few firms that are publicly traded and you know, the private markets have valued higher. I think that there are probably many reasons for that. But in part, I think there's a belief that in a private format, that's a better way to drive value and drive forward through a consolidating phase.
Because it's
just not easy, yeah. right? I mean, yeah. you know, you want to manage your earnings quarter to quarter while you're in a consolidating phase. I mean, it's a hard thing to forecast. And right. so I think
there's... So it's the maturity and life cycle of our industry is
that's
kind
right.
of what you're saying.
That's okay. right. right. And so I think that's part of it, right? And mm-hmm. that's part of what's driving... If you look at the PE firms... They're very interested in consolidating industries, mm-hmm. right? That's not unique to wealth management, but so that's why they're interested in wealth management as a area. But I mean, but that's a broad sort of view. I think then you bring it down a little narrow. That's kind of the broad view. We bring it down a little more narrowly, and they look from a historical perspective and they say, wow, a lot of PE firms have done quite well for their investors by going after the insurance brokerage business, right? And I mentioned earlier, you know, the insurance brokerage business is about 10 years mm-hmm. ahead of us, I would say, mm-hmm. a decade or maybe more. And, you know, very successful firms have developed their same approach, right? Yep. Which is, you know, they're dealing with, in terms of delivery of what this ultimate service is, but you're dealing with, you know, very capable service providers that are, you know, passionate about their business. And yet there was a reason for that to consolidate. And it did. As the capital came in, and you know, I think any PE firm that's been in the financial services has been part of an insurance brokerage roll up, and so that one's in the later innings. So then they kind of look and say, well, what's a corollary, mm-hmm. right? So that's part of what kind of wealth management. We mm-hmm. you know, we already see a few people doing that. Let's do that.
Well, and I think what you're also seeing in our industry too is that I find a lot of the private equity investors are really attracted to it's still growing. You're still seeing more. I mean, it's amazing. During COVID, we actually saw more firms being formed even as consolidation is unfolding. So it's still an expanding space. It's a stable revenue stream. It's all those kind of attractive dynamics that I think an investor would look for.
Yeah. So. Those attractive dynamics have created really nice valuations yes. for everybody in this industry, right? And I think everyone should feel very proud of where they are and comfortable because, I mean, look, you start with, we provide, you know, we have a purpose statement that we talk about, which is, you know, we work together. We're a very team culture. Mm-hmm. And the second part is that we do that to improve the lives of our clients. And then the third part is, you know, that we are always seeking to be the best, right? Mm-hmm. So the operative part there is seeking, right? Is be humble and get better mm-hmm. In the last part. But that middle one is really important, and which is that we're here not and this apply, you know, this is how we think about it, but mm-hmm. I know everybody in this industry, you know, and really thinks about it, sort of how do I make my clients' lives better mm-hmm. and that's a noble thing. Client retention levels in this business are incredibly high, and you know, even compared, like, you know, people look at like the technology and fintech, right, and the multiples they have. Well, you know, part of the reason why multiples are high in this business is because the people in it grasp that, you know, the middle part of our purpose statement. I know others grasp this, which is like, we're here to improve clients' lives. You get in that door and you reciprocate and honor them back by giving them great advice. You're there. I mean, you're together, right? I mean, you're going to be together for a long time. That stickiness, right, is attractive to outside capital coming into the space, right? Is that
great,
we have really high retention rates. And because of those high retention rates, the value of these firms are quite high.
Great. Well, let's talk then about, you know, you've worked with a number of different private equity players and you know other firms as well. And as you said, they actually would like to buy firms that are well run already and they don't have to. But at the same time, I know in talking to you in the past, you've gotten a lot of help
from some of
this. So talk a little about the role that private equity has played and where that's constructive to helping make a better enterprise, you know, whether it's in governance, whether it's in helping on M&A, because many firms actually that's the arm for some players. That's their M&A arm.
Yeah.
Et cetera.
Yeah. No, for sure. You know, look, one of the byproducts of a PE firm is that you get these really smart people who have a vested interest in the success of the business. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good thing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, some people sometimes may not, you know, if you're at odds with that, then maybe
so
it's not such a good thing.
You've got to be aligned with that.
Yeah.
Their thinking and their process.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's, you know, I always say this, not all PE firms are the same. And that doesn't mean that's not a value judgment of some versus others. It's just they have different views about how they participate and add value to the firms they're involved with. Getting to know that is really important. That's, you know.
So how did you do that so that you knew it? And what were you looking for? And what were they looking for? And how did you bring that together?
Each of the private equity firms that come in, I've known for years before they became partners. So Norwest Equity Partners happens to be a firm based out of Minneapolis. I'd known them for maybe a decade before, just through contacts. We went to Light Your Capital. I had met them a couple of years earlier. You know, I had, you know, learned a little bit about the partners and how they looked at things. Don Marin, you know, built Payne Weber.
Yeah.
So what I liked about them is it was a PE space that actually had some operating experience behind it, had actually built a business and a substantial one at that. You know, I could talk to Don, he recently passed away about a year or two ago, but I could talk to Don and in 5 minutes, I could get an unbelievable amount of, you know, insights and wisdom from him. And that was incredibly helpful as we were forming sort of what are the key metrics of our business? How should we think about them? And how should we think about them as we move into an acquisitive phase more aggressively? And so, you know, I find it incredibly helpful. I think in the case of when we had NEP come in, they helped us immensely. We were a young company.
Mm-hmm.
And
life cycle of where you are in your growth rate
matters
at that point and who you're aligning with. Okay.
Matters. So, I mean, in fact, their big contribution was investing in the leadership team and the organization.
Okay.
And they
okay.
really helped me with that. When they came in, you know, when they came in, we had a leadership team of maybe 1.5.
Okay.
And when they exited, we were probably 4 or 5 in a pretty strong way. And today we have TA and Onyx. You know, TA, you know, they have a capital markets group, right? Mm-hmm. Which is incredibly helpful as we think about financing the business. They have, I don't know, somewhere between 15 or 20 consultants on staff, former BCG, McKinsey, you know, Bain types in very specific industry. I mean, they really help us sort of define like, hey, here's an area we're trying to figure this out. What can we learn from this? What are insights you've seen across your organization? Lightyear did this a lot as well. You know, they sort of shared common sort of best practices. TA, they have this internal consulting group that's available to us.
Mm-hmm.
Where they've been incredibly helpful to us is we're trying to scope a problem by which we're going to actually push it out to maybe a consulting group or maybe even internally. Incredibly helpful to us in terms of defining the scope, the key, you know, sort of what are the key metrics within success? What are the key issues that you have to actually get identified and bring clarity to before you actually go forward with this?
So private equity brings a lot of expertise to firms that are willing to accept it and look to it, and
that's
they
right.
can become a better firm. But in the end, Jeff, the reason you really do this is you're looking for investors to actually help you, you know, have more capital so that you can do your M&A strategy,
that's
which
right.
you've done very well. Let's talk about a little bit about what that looks like and how that has helped you and other firms like yours to be able to accelerate and do this, you know, where we've seen record M&A for the last several years.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we started on M&A with NEP,
mm-hmm.
but then really kind of, you know, took it up a notch with Lightyear. And I think there was a couple things that they really helped us with. First of all, our first M&A, like, you know, he's a good friend of mine,
mm-hmm.
but it was rough, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the first, you know, anytime you go through the first cycle with him.
Every single firm I've talked to on these podcasts, everybody is, you know, Marty Bicknell, everybody else, they've all said the first transaction was a little rough because there are a lot of lessons in the process.
Yeah. The first thing is it's like, you know, it's not like the world's a nail and you're a hammer, right?
Yeah.
You know, we pretty quickly got to this concept and said, you know, if we think we're going to change them, like we got a problem,
yeah.
right? That gets back to that humble part of our purpose statement. we've learned as much from the firms that have come in and have, as they've come in and have helped us actually become better as an organization, that, you know, far more at this point from all of them collectively than what we knew when we started this. And I think you have to be, you know, if you're going to do this game, this is a people business, and people, you know, you have to value people. And the way you value people is you listen. And when there's great ideas,
yep,
the respect shown is we're going to do that. Like, you know, we're going to adopt that. So
what about with the deals themselves? So you're getting more capital, it's enabling you to do more. So how's that?
Yeah. So I think when Lightyear came in, they really helped us with sort of putting in, you know, help us get kind of version one of a really strong diligence and integration process. Okay. Right. Cause they had done it and they'd firsthand, you know, they were front row seats in any number of other firms by mm-hmm. which they had done that. And so I think that's, you know, if you look at it and say, hey, they can give you headlights so you can go faster, right? Or you can not make mistakes. That's really important. So they just helped us with process, financial diligence being obviously a big part of that, helping us really structure sort of the legal contract part of it. And right. And making sure that we were sort of doing that in a smart way. I remember our, you know, they came in. And they, you know, we had done a couple of transactions. I remember this 30 days after they closed, we said, yeah, we've got this transaction we want to do. And they were sort of surprised, right? Because it was, you know, when they buy, they don't know exactly what they're getting,
right?
Yeah,
let's see what we're
getting. You know, and of course we were forecasting, you know, we have this and this. And we were like 30 days in, we're like, yep, this is where it's at. And they kind of were taken back a little bit. And so we did a more fulsome review of everything, but it was really good. You know, they went through it in detail, and we actually, you know, we could use a real live, you know, situation and really optimize why we were in flight with that. And so I think that's just expertise, like having seen it before, you know, receiving that input, saying, mm-hmm. okay, that I'm not going to do that. Like, I hear you. Like, that was dumb.
What about capital itself? And
yeah.
In some cases, firms are, I mean, in these funds, they put aside capital, they're investing in others. They're enabling you to get access to bank, exactly. Other private sources.
So the question, you know, within that, when you think about accessing either debt capital, right, or additional equity capital, yep. is what are the foundations of your process so that you have quality, right? You know, so that you can demonstrate quality, because, you know, just because you have debt capital doesn't, I mean, that's a smart group of people as well, right? And they need to understand what your business is about. So, you know, putting in that infrastructure and capability so that you can actually go through the diligence process and you can understand that you have that type of cash flow and therefore you can access this type of financing, like job one. Mm-hmm. Like without that, you can't get that. I think what PE firms really help you do within that, and you can see this, is there's a fairly strong direct lending group. So many advisors might use direct lenders mm-hmm. for their clients, right? Mm-hmm. And so they may be aware of it, but it's a private source of capital as well, in which you have a organization structured like a, you know, sort of structured like a hedge fund, you know, yep. Generic hedge fund structure, right? Where it's a 2 in 20 probably deal for that. And what they're doing is they're putting out debt to companies, you know, that are private. And they'll come in and they'll say, here's, you know, we're going to place this much debt and we have these types of covenants and things like that. Covenants meaning, you know, for, yep. for those on listening, you know, is like these, you have to meet these, yep. right? Yep. You have to live up to these. If you're in violation of a covenant, then
here are the boundaries.
Yeah, exactly. Here are the boundaries. Here is where the red flags and yep. sirens start going off. And so, you know, what I think PE space has, you know, no secret, the PE space, and part of the reason why it's been a great decade for them is they use leverage. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just do. And you can use leverage in a situation where if you have an equity player, leverage is easier to use, right? Mm-hmm. Versus, you know, you can kind of see in the public markets. Public markets typically, public companies, the markets don't really like them to use too much leverage, right? You know, because suddenly you got this equity group that's very disperse
yep.
within it. In the private space, they've been a little bit more aggressive about using debt within an organization, and they can do that, right? Because you got a much more simple sort of equity structure within it. You know, kind of put it as a couple parts of it. Make sure you got great diligence and that you really understand what you're getting.
Yeah.
And then make sure once in, you've got great control of your expenses. Otherwise, you know, if you don't have those fundamental, you know, sort of capabilities, then, you know, accessing the debt market's going to be tough. Yeah.
Yeah. So ultimately, what should our audience understand then in terms of, you know, our audience are largely advisors of all sizes and large and small and everything else, but in terms of the kind of the debt to equity kind of perspective that you're looking at in a private equity environment, because sometimes we hear message about, oh, this firm's over leveraged and so forth. How do you see that?
How do you think about that?
Yeah.
Well, look, I think, you know, the industry, not the industry, just in general, when you think about leverage these days, you know, debt capital is more expensive, mm-hmm. right? And so the question is,
more expensive in this environment now.
More expensive now, right? Yeah. You know, add, you know, 350 basis points yeah. to SOFR and the cost of debt is higher.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and that's really important to think about businesses. Where are we at? And so on the cost of capital, the question is, what are firms doing in light of the change of cost of capital? And if it's if they're doing same as always before, that's probably not going to work. I mean, it's just math.
Yeah,
I mean,
the ROI is not going to be.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah. And look, I mean, there's at some point. I mean, if it doesn't work at that level, right? I mean, it's return, but at some level, I mean, it just doesn't pencil out, right?
Okay.
I mean, the ability to, you know, putting out the capital, right? So you're buying the business, right? You're releasing, you know, capital out. The question is, you know, you do have to get that capital back through the profitability of that business, and you know, coming at that and saying, I'm going to apply the same sort of approach I've always done, but I'm going to ignore the fact that the debt that's part of this transaction is, you know, maybe 300-400 basis points more than it used to be. Mm-hmm. That's a problem, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're talking about kind of 40 to, you know, maybe 60% more expensive cost of capital than where it was before. It doesn't work, right? And it doesn't work because, I mean, and as I say, I mean, it's just math, right? And
so given that, let's talk a little bit about the current environment where we're seeing a rapid rise in rates after a long period of low cost capital. What's that mean for our industry as you see it and the whole thesis around the consolidation that we're seeing and where's it headed?
Look, I think, you know, I'll tell you what, so our view was when you think about a consolidation, mm-hmm. there's a question of speed and quality of integration, ultimately leading to sort of synergistic value. I think for the last, you know, when capital's cheap, speed's the winner, mm-hmm. right? Why are the tech companies getting hit so hard, right? Mm-hmm. And tech companies are getting hit so hard is because they're not all that profitable, right? Mm-hmm. But when you have a, you know, hypothetically, you have a zero real interest rate, future profitability, you know, the discount from that future profitability is small, right? And so therefore they're high value, right? I mean, everybody gets this, right? So I think as you think about how does that pertain to us, what we set up was we said productivity is going to matter in this industry at some point. Mm-hmm. And this goes from a strategic perspective. I have this dumb thing. It actually came from NEP. They had a group offsite session years ago. And it's this idea of, you know, food and water. Mm-hmm. And in its most basic sense is what's the food and water for the unknown? And it comes from, you know, when you know, Christopher Columbus was trying to gather some people to go discover the new world, you know, people would say, well, we don't know what's out there, right? We have no idea. We don't know what we're going to find. So of course the question is, well, you know, we can't really plan for all the scenarios, what we see, but do we have food and do we have water? Because mm-hmm. we know we'll need that, right? And so strategically you think about that. And so we've always thought about productivity as an important part of our business, is that we have to think about how can we put out more value to the client than our competitors? Mm-hmm. And what are the tools and ways we can do that? And so within that, we saw that a little bit more as a tool we would use, assuming that, you know, the rates of a year ago and the economy of a year ago was going to continue for a while and the forward curve would have suggested that was there. It was really there to say, hey, we think someday there's going to be chapter two M&A, meaning big firms buying each other.
So some of the large enterprises are out there buying each. Yeah, I agree that will come eventually. And
I think
that's what
come.
You see in other industries too.
I think that'll come. But we feel that productivity will be the engine of who succeeds there. So that was really when we were writing our story about what we might see when we go off sailing, you know, our story was, we think the way this is going to play out is this. But we felt our food and water in a lot of scenarios was about productivity. And scale is part of that. And how do you have the ability to access that? Well, today, when the cost of capital is higher, I would argue that when the cost of capital was cheap, productivity didn't really have a seat at the table of value creation. I mean, it was there, but it didn't really have a formal seat. Well, when you change the cost of capital, productivity, and you increase the cost of capital, productivity has a major seat at the table today. And I think that's really important. So as we think about in this market, what matters, we look at our transaction, we say, you know what, in the past, it was speed. Capital was cheap. It was about speed. And, you know, some of the statistics mm-hmm. you guys have on us and things like that would say we demonstrated some speed. Mm-hmm. Today, you know, we have more capability to continue at pretty high pace. But we also are very interested in, let's make sure that this is leading to sort of a better outcome for the clients of that firm, because we're going to be able to find productivity to continue to serve them. And that's rooted all the way back into the cost of capital.
That's a really helpful perspective on what's changing. So ultimately, as we look at this, how is this helping our industry to lead to better outcomes for clients? You've touched on a few things there, but how would you kind of characterize that all this capital coming in here, all this M&A activity, how's it leading to a better outcome?
Yeah. Well, I think that, so one of the first things I saw, you know, if I just kind of go back, mm-hmm. you know, rewind the tape for a little bit, and I kind of talk about, you know, the idea that, you know, building a business through M&A is really not that great. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's true. But I would say that maybe something slightly less productive than that was successions, right? Mm-hmm. When I first came into the industry, we were driven through organic growth. Mm-hmm. But I was watching successions, you know, happening outside of the firm. And they often didn't go so well, mm-hmm. right? And I think there's some fundamental reasons for it. You know, typically, I mean, the founders of these businesses are, you know, they're first-rate entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. right? And entrepreneurs, they have a spirit. Like, you don't just rubber stamp those out, right? And they smartly then bring in, you know, advisors who probably are maybe just a little bit more operationally disciplined. Mm-hmm. Entrepreneurs are very visionary, right? They're very passionate, great energy. They can take that energy. They need that because that's what gets them through the dark valleys occasionally of being an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. So that faith in the vision. But then they balance themselves, the smart ones, right? Balance themselves with people who actually bring a slightly different approach, more operational mindset. Yep. The risk level of those two different people is very different. And I think when you look at G2, they're phenomenal talent. Like, they are doing great work for their clients. They don't necessarily want to personally lever up and buy those businesses, right?
I see it all the time.
And
I agree.
And yep. I think that you saw a lot of that. So there was a need for successful transitions of the capital, sort of the equity ownership of yep. these firms, right? And so I think when you look at that, you know, we have a very comprehensive succession program. We've got something like 30 or 40% of our assets have transitioned from original advisor to younger successor who's taken that over. You know, both parties have done well and the clients have done well because they knew that successor years before it ever happened.
And they have continuity.
Yeah, there's complete continuity, yep. right? I mean, that's when we talk to smaller firms, I mean, one of the first things they'll say is clients are asking me, what's going to happen, right? And, yep. and so we've got this program that we have, you know, now you think about it, there's a three-way vested interest in the outcome of the client, right? There's the person who's retiring and we create some incentives for them. There's the person who's taking it over as the lead advisor. And then there's this company as well. It actually functions really well. I mean, we all have the same alignment, but it also, we all sort of can call it out and say, oh, that's not working so well, right? Let's raise our hand and let's figure out how to make that a little bit better within that.
I know you've talked to me too, some other ways, because that's an important one, is this whole issue of continuity and succession for the clients that creates a better outcome. But there are other elements that we all use this word scale, but ultimately it's around, you know, I think you've talked to me about some of these ideas around the growth in fintech, what we've seen with kind of the move towards greater personalization and so forth. So give a little bit about, you know, how's this leading to a better outcome because of where you're building with larger enterprises are going to be able to deliver more of this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, just macro drivers, right? Is there's mm-hmm. there's this sense that over the coming years, we're going to have less advisors than we did before, right? Because of demographics.
And it's a huge, a lot of the M&A that's out there is because of trying to get human capital.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
We look at, you know, what are we doing as an organization? The question sort of, you know, scale, right? Does scale matter? Is the amount of money that we invest in terms of how can we continue to drive productivity as you move towards things, thinking about like personalization and hyper-personalization that might occur, you know, because the clients want more, mm-hmm. not less.
Yep.
And yet we might have a smaller resource of people who can deliver, right? So I think scale is bringing companies together. I know my competitors are doing the same types of things. What are you doing from a developmental perspective? Yes, there's technology you buy off the, you know, sort of street or whatever and put it in, right, or off the shelf. But then how are you then customizing and bringing that for deliverable? And so, you know, look, as a firm, we have five active agile teams, you know, working through continuous improvement related to all sorts of different work streams in our business. And so, you know, we have developers that are working on that. We, you know, an agile team typically has four or five people on it in terms of product manager.
And that translates to a better, like the advisors freed up with more capacity.
And
be able to execute better for the clients.
Yeah. And I mean, some of our work streams are direct client related.
Yeah.
And some of our work streams are internal back office. But all of that is about how do we just continue to like deliver more value for less cost. And I think you have to have scale, right? That's, you know, ultimately, right? Just not to leave that unsaid, is that that's the benefit that starts to come out of scale. And what's great about this industry is that our firms are focused, right? I mean, you look at the platform firms here, they're not in ancillary businesses, right? I mean, that's what I love about it, right? We're not sort of, you know, conglomerates of financial services, right? Where, yeah, we have a name, but, you know, just we do all sorts of different things. I mean, we're all pretty focused. And
I know, it's true.
Pretty driven.
Sticking to the knitting on a lot of it and just executing better
that's right.
with some of that. So as we begin to wind up here, if if there's someone out here listening to us who's, say, a $200 or $250 million AUM principal of a firm, what would be your message to them? What is all this capital that's in the industry and all these investors, what's it really mean to them for them today and for their future? And how should they be thinking about all this, Jeff?
Yeah. So look, I'm a person who always thinks about transfer value, right? I just, like, it's really simple. Like, can I transfer this business to a different owner or not? And I would encourage, you know, if I'm an entrepreneur and I have a business that's $250 million in assets, how do I think about this business from a transfer value? Very first thing, you got, you know, depending on your age and where you are, I mean, you have to have clear sort of next leadership, and they have to be motivated and properly brought in, right? They have to have skin in the game within that. And so how do you get that alignment with that leadership? Because if you don't have that, the transfer becomes really problematic, right? Because who you know, you might have all the equity, but the G2 might have all the clients, and sometimes equity and client focus can cause conflict in that. Work hard, you know, work incredibly hard. We're in the services business. We're lucky to work with each other. Work hard to make sure you got your G2 aligned.
You use that term a lot today, too, but alignment of capital in terms of timing, alignment of interest between investor and firm. And now you're also talking about, in this case, even all the way down the pike, it's like, are you aligned with what the future is for constituents of, yeah, you know, different owners, well, in an enterprise?
My Yoda would say, I don't suffer drama well. And all I know is that when there is an alignment, there seems to be lots of drama.
Well, that's a good way to put it.
So, yeah, I think it, you know, so I absolutely drive at that. We're a people business, right? So I can talk about technology, right? It's not to replace us. It's just, it's really there to say, how do we become more productive?
Great.
And all of us have to make sure that we have that kind of alignment. Our culture matters to us. You know, I do a broadcast to everyone in the company twice a month via video. We talk about values all the time within that. We have people, outside speakers. I mean, the culture of the organization is critical, whether you're five people or, you know, 1,200 people or 12,000. And so, you know, I really would say, get that clear. Next thing I would say, as a, you know, someone thinking about maybe in my horizon, I'm going to transact, get to know where you can go, right? I think a lot of times what happens is people get into these processes. They might hire a business broker or a banker to help them out. That's good. I mean, I wouldn't dissuade them from doing that. But oftentimes once you enter that process, it's about the number. And the number is important. I'm not dismissing that. But almost every advisor I've met, I mean, they poured their life in taking care of these people. And those people are both their employees and their clients. Getting to know the players, understanding that there's differences between, just like I said, not all the PE firms are the same. Not all the consolidators mm-hmm. are the same either. There's some pretty distinct differences. Get to know them, right? Don't get to know them when you're thinking about selling. Get to know them now. Maybe it's directly, maybe it's through somebody that you know that's transacted with them, but understand sort of what their model is and start thinking about, is that in keeping with us? I when I talk to, you know, prospective firms coming in, I tell them, look, the promises that you've made to your clients and your employees become our collective promises. So we really want to try to understand them. It's hard to understand all of them, obviously, right? I mean, you know, we're talking down to the very last promise. I mean, that's hard to get to. But
yeah. Well, forgot about that.
Yeah, exactly, right? I mean, easy to do. But what's really, what is the theme of the promises you've made? And is that in keeping with who we are and what we're trying to do as an organization? And if though, it gets back to this alignment concept. If those don't work, that transaction's not going to work. And even if you sold out, you still care about your employees. You still care about your clients. And you want that to be a good outcome.
Well, Jeff, this has really been an enlightening conversation. And we began this whole thing, as you said at the outset, that M&A is not a great way to build a business. And then, of course, our whole subject and the topic of this podcast series is around M&A. But what you've, I think, enlightened us on is why a lot of this is happening, to ultimately create a better enterprise and a better outcome for investors, and the impact of capital and how these capital providers, these private equity providers, can really enhance the business, not just in providing capital, but providing expertise and helping enterprises to become a lot better. So it's not just about consolidating and getting bigger. It's really about creating a better execution. Anything you want to add as we wrap up?
Look, it's an exciting, this industry is exciting. I mean, I say I'm the accidental CEO, right? I'm going to do this for 6 months. And I got taken by, you know, working with these amazing advisors. And, you know, it was a little different, right? When you marketed, you know, Cheerios and the truck left, it never, you know, the box never waved back at you, right? You know, here it's like, oh, That was an interesting comment. That was, you know, that was a little sharp, but it was like challenging in such a great way. And I have to say, like, I've loved sort of moving from sort of the marketing of intangibles to the marketing and development of a business that's related to services really and people.
On issues that matter deeply to the clients of your firm.
Yeah. So I mean, how can you not be energized by it? So it's, you know, it's just been a great honor to be in this business. And look, the RIA space, I mean, we are all collectively creating something new and better for clients. We are stealing share, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody knows that this has been going on for 10 years plus, right? Is the RIA space is growing market share. And that's stealing share for the benefit of clients. And it's a model that I think is, you know, so much more aligned with the client. It's better. And so, you know, it's congratulations to everyone in the space. It's an exciting time. We're all part of this.
Keep going and let's build better enterprises. Well, good. I think you've brought a lot of great insight for our audience to understand how private equity is really shaping the business for the better and what these different partnerships look like. And again, it builds on the strength of what our industry is all about, which is relationship. Yeah. So Jeff, thanks for being with us today and for contributing to Future Ready through M&A.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
As a reminder, if you haven't listened to season one or season two yet, you can visit go.fidelity.com/mergers and acquisitions. Or you can find us on Apple Podcasts to catch up on past episodes. And I do encourage you to listen to some of these leaders who bring great insights on their perspectives on building these businesses. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast to get the latest M&A insights and to hear from firms like yours who have gone through a transaction. Find out what they've learned, what they'd never do again, and how they've grown as a result of the transaction. Well, that's it for us today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Future Ready through M&A. I'm Scott Slater, reminding you to be future ready.
GFC is used as an acronym for Great Financial Crisis. Reference citation for this episode. M&A activity statistics are from the Fidelity Wealth Management M&A Transaction Report. Several sources are used to create this report. M&A data is gathered from press releases, trade articles, and other secondary research sources. All publicly announced transactions involving the acquisition of an independent advisory firm are reviewed for inclusion. The data shared in this podcast is representative through October 31st, 2022. For investment professional use or institutional investor use only, information provided in this document is for informational and educational purposes only. To the extent any investment information in this material is deemed to be a recommendation, it is not meant to be impartial investment advice or advice in a fiduciary capacity, and is not intended to be used as a primary basis for you or your client's investment decisions. Fidelity and its representatives may have a conflict of interest in the products or services mentioned in this material because they have a financial interest in them, and receive compensation, directly or indirectly, in connection with the management, distribution, and/or servicing of these products or services, including Fidelity funds, certain third-party funds and products, and certain investment services. The third-party providers listed herein are neither affiliated with nor an agent of Fidelity, and are not authorized to make representations on behalf of Fidelity. Their input herein does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information was provided by the third-party providers and is subject to change. The content provided and maintained by any third-party website is not owned or controlled by Fidelity. Fidelity takes no responsibility whatsoever nor in any way endorses any such content. There is no form of legal partnership, agency, affiliation, or similar relationship among an investment professional, the third-party service providers, and Fidelity Investments, nor is such a relationship created or implied by the information herein. Third-party trademarks and service marks are the property of their respective owners. All other trademarks and service marks are the property of FMR LLC or its affiliated companies. Fidelity Institutional provides investment products through Fidelity Distributors Company, LLC. Clearing, custody, or other brokerage services through National Financial Services, LLC, or Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Members NYSE, SIPC. Copyright 2022 FMR, LLC. All rights reserved. 10644381.1.0 1.9908935.100.